Welcome to Campus Conversation. This week's podcast features top U of I researcher Martin Burke, a chemist with an MD and a PhD from Harvard, and research dean at the New Carl Illinois College of Medicine. We talked about his work, which could lead to a whole new approach to treating disease, and the new medical school's plans to work with patients, students, and other citizen scientists to transform medical care. We'll be back after this.
Hey, Jim Rosso, News Gazette Media, reminding you that at newsgazette.com we have a ton of podcasts every week, from Brian Barnhart's Penny for Your Thoughts to Scott Beatty's News Hour to Elizabeth Hess, Dave Gentry talking with movers and shakers on their morning show. Head to newsgazette.com and search for podcasts.
My guest for Campus Conversation today is Martin Burke, a chemistry professor and award-winning researcher at the University of Illinois. His research focuses on synthesizing small molecules that hold big promise in the treatment of diseases like cystic fibrosis. He's also dean for research at the New Carl Illinois College of Medicine and generally a human dynamo. Martin, thanks for joining us today.
All right, thanks for having me.
Why don't we start by talking about your background? You grew up in Maryland, correct?
Sure.
And went to Johns Hopkins. And how did you end up with both an MD and PhD from Harvard?
Sure. So I grew up in a very small town in Maryland called Manchester. It's about an hour northwest of Baltimore and a very small rural community. We actually like to say we had more cows than people and one traffic light, actually. So when I left for college, we actually got a second one, which was a very exciting event.
Wow, this is a traditional story.
And so I think like a lot of, you know, people maybe growing up in a rural community, you're not necessarily exposed to, you know, as many different types of things. And so you're very much inspired, of course, by the things that you are exposed to. So I very much wanted to either be a professional baseball player or a physician. So I was deeply inspired by both. We had a family physician, Dr. Ford, I'll never forget him, who was just incredible. And, you know, I remember being very inspired by the, you know, kind of impact that he had on our family and the way in which he, you know, went about caring for his patients. And I think that had a huge impression upon me. And I also actually had a high school science teacher who, you know, introduced for the first time into the lab environment the idea of making aspirin. So he had actually kind of taught us how to do this actually in the lab. Wow. And I think that also planted a seed. So when I went then to kind of think about what I wanted to do, the Orioles never called. So, this stuff kind of works itself out. So, but luckily Johns Hopkins did. And so I was just absolutely thrilled to have the chance to go attend university actually at Johns Hopkins University. And it was just a transformative experience. And when I got there, I started as a pre-med and majored in chemistry. And then soon when I arrived, I met Christina White. This is just one of the most extraordinary people I've ever met, who is now my wife. But she also taught me how incredibly powerful chemistry can be. You know, she had figured out that when you learn how to make molecules, you make yourself a very powerful person. And she really kind of helped me understand the tremendous power associated with that. And so I became kind of deeply inspired about now chemistry and still thinking about human health. I had a chance to work for Henry Brehm in his lab. He's now head of neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins, and started to see how kind of powerful chemistry and science could be when translated into human therapeutics. And all of this kind of spinning in my head, and I didn't really know then what I wanted to do. I think it was really kind of, I was conflicted. I was still very much passionate about medicine, but now I also had gained a really strong interest and passion for kind of basic science and chemistry. And so it was then really almost the non-decision to apply to MD-PhD programs, because, you know, I just couldn't make up my mind as to which direction I think I wanted to go. And so I was very fortunate to have the opportunity to go do an MD-PhD at Harvard Medical School and Harvard University. And this was kind of the path that got me there to start with. I'm happy to tell you more if you'd like about once we got there, but I'd let you cast your question.
Did you always want to do both, or did you at some point, you must have chosen science at some
right.
point?
Right. So when I arrived, I still very much, I think, wanted to do both when I got to Harvard. And the way it works there, you spend 2 years doing medical school classes. Then you go do your PhD. And then you go back and finish your medical school classes. Actually, very interesting. And so, you know, I really kind of was just absolutely fascinated with both aspects. So it was a real kind of struggle for me. But when I started doing my PhD and started to myself learn how to make molecules, it was just a transformative experience. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing to be able to do, because you literally then start your imagination running wild with, could you create something new at the molecular scale that could impact society? And you start to see the leverage, you know, associated with that potential. I mean, if a new medicine comes along, for example, it could be millions of people, right, that end up being benefited from this. So I think that I became almost addicted to the power associated with that possibility, and my head was spinning. And so I, you know, had an experience when I was on my clinical rotations then that really, I think, was a transformative one for me. So there was this young woman I was trying to help take care of who has cystic fibrosis. She's a 22-year-old college student, actually, in Boston, incredibly brilliant. And she was taking 17 medicines on a daily basis.
17, wow.
And none of them were actually addressing the problem. They're addressing the symptoms that result from the fact that she's missing this protein called CFTR. So I'll never forget, I was actually in her room and actually on the whiteboard, you know, where the nurse writes the instructions.
Right.
I was actually describing to her kind of probably in excruciating detail, because I just learned a lot about it in my classes, you know, exactly what was wrong with the protein that's missing in her lung that was causing her not to be able to transport salt and therefore get these infections. And at some point in this conversation, she stopped me and she was like, look, it sounds like you know exactly what's wrong with me. Why can't you fix it?
Wow.
And this was just a, you know, incredibly inspiring and for me, game-changing moment. I mean, she had identified a critical unmet medical need and a gap where there are many cases now, in fact, hundreds of human diseases that are known down to the molecular level to be caused by a specific protein that's missing. And yet, in most of those cases, there's no cure. We treat the symptoms, the consequences of those deficiencies, but in most cases, we cannot actually treat the underlying molecular defect. And so for me, this was really, I think, a transformative conversation and moment. And as a chemist, and knowing how powerful small molecules can be as drugs, most of the medicines we take are small molecules, I think the idea started to emerge that, you know, wouldn't it be amazing if we could find small molecules, so new types of medicines that can replace the missing protein, you know, almost like a prosthesis on the molecular scale, okay? So this is the idea that we started to get, you know, very, very excited about. And I think that really started to draw me towards the idea of launching my own research group and going after it. And so long story short, pretty much went all in. So when I applied for academic positions, I was just thrilled to have the chance to come here to University of Illinois to start my own lab. And we went all in. So that's where we are.
I want to talk to you about that decision too at some point. But let's talk about your research in layman's terms. What are some of these other diseases that, you know, have that this research has potential for, and how does your research work?
Yes. Okay, great. So I'll start with the latter question. So
sure.
How does the research work? So what we'd like to do is to try to identify a human disease that is caused by the deficiency of a specific protein. So to kind of connect it to what already exists, most of the medicines that we take, they work by binding to proteins and turning them off. This is really kind of the classic paradigm of pharmacology. So if you have a headache, you have an enzyme in your body called cyclooxygenase that is, in a sense, hyperactive. It's doing too much of what it does, and it's leading to inflammatory signals, and it's making your head hurt.
Oh.
And so when you take aspirin, it actually
inhibits. Anti-inflammatory, right?
Exactly. And the way it works is it blocks that enzyme. It shuts it off. And so you have too much function is causing your problem, and the medicine reduces the function and makes you better. So your headache goes away. So if your disease is caused by too much function, then obviously that approach can work really well. And it does. And again, we have, you know, hundreds of medicines that work that way.
Okay.
If instead your disease is caused by a deficiency, if you're missing a protein, unfortunately now this classic paradigm falls apart, because by definition, there's no target. There's no protein to inhibit because you're already deficient in function. And so the idea and the research focuses on trying to find small molecules, so not proteins, but actually like medicines that do what the missing protein is supposed to do. And when we started talking about this, actually, there was a lot of pushback because proteins are really complicated. They're very complex, very sophisticated, tightly regulated. They're selective entities that often work in the context of a very complex cell, and they integrate and all of these things. So what people said to me when we tried to kind of, you know, vociferously argue for this idea, was that you'll never perfectly replicate the function of a protein with a small molecule. And so we conceded from the outset that was actually probably very much true. Hmm. The argument was that imperfection could be enough. That was really, I think, our key hypothesis. So on the macroscopic scale, it's the same. Like if you're missing a hand, even a very simple prosthetic device can actually
help
make a huge impact, because your other hand can work harder and you can get very creative and find ways to fill in some of the, you know, remaining deficiency and actually restore a lot of quality of life, right, with a pretty simple prosthetic device. The hypothesis was the same thing would be true on the molecular scale, that even if you had an imperfect mimic of this missing protein, because living systems are very robust, like we want to live. There's so many different aspects of physiology that say, you know, we've got redundant excess function that kind of fills in the blanks in many cases. And that's why in most cases, if you're missing a protein, there's no consequence.
Oh.
It's just in a rare case where you're missing a certain type of protein that you get a disease. So we thought, okay, if you had a small molecule that even partially mimics the function of a missing protein, maybe that would be enough. And you could actually allow the system to find a way to work with this partial mimic to get itself back to physiology. That was really our core hypothesis. And so I'm excited to tell you, we've got data now to back it up. So we used to just be dreaming about it, and now we've got, you know, actual results to back it up. And I think that's the most important thing we found thus far, is that now in multiple cases, we found imperfect mimicry of a missing protein can be sufficient to vigorously restore physiology in a living system. And now that I think that looks to be increasingly true, I mean, look out. This looks like a potential new way to think about treating diseases caused by missing proteins.
Well, in fact, it's sort of a whole new area of medicine, right? Or medical treatment, possibly.
We hope so. I mean, I think it really does get your imagination spinning about, you know, a different way to try to address some of the really challenging unmet medical needs that have, you know, lasted despite all advances in modern medicine. And there's unfortunately a lot of diseases out there for which there is no cure, and many of them fall into this category. And
like so, cystic fibrosis,
like cystic fibrosis is a really good one. And you asked about others. So another one that we've now kind of really started to think deeply about are anemias. So there actually are a number of proteins in our body that are important for transporting iron across lipid bilayers. So as you know, iron is really important. It's actually really important for our blood. So the hemoglobin that is in your red blood cells, which is allow you to transport oxygen right from your lungs to your tissues. A key component of hemoglobin is iron. And
right.
It's actually the iron that binds the oxygen that allows you to, you know, bring the oxygen to the rest of your body. And so there are certain diseases that are caused by missing proteins that bring the iron in to your body, or help it get out of your liver, for example. So there's a whole kind of iron movement throughout your body that needs to be maintained in order to get blood made and in order to be able to, you know, respirate. And so patients who are missing these proteins have sometimes very severe anemias, and it can become a huge problem. It also happens in patients who get inflammation, very interestingly. So we have thought to be an evolutionary conserved mechanism. If you become some type of infection and you get inflammation, your body doesn't want the bugs to have iron. So we actually have a mechanism where we become temporarily anemic as a protection against the bug. It's actually very interesting. So if you actually have an infection and for 1 week you get, you know, slightly anemic, it's fine. And then you get over the infection, you get back to normal, and everything's fine. If instead you have inflammation because you have arthritis or inflammatory bowel disease or heart disease or any other number of kind of autoimmune type diseases, you become anemic, but it's not good for you, because you're not actually fighting an infection. And this is like tens of millions of people over the world are anemic, and they're missing this same protein, actually. It's called ferroportin. So there are patients born without this protein, and they get, you know, the same problem. And there are patients who lose it because of this inflammation, and they get the same problem. And so we became very excited about trying to go after that. Could you find a small molecule that could perform transmembrane iron transport, right, to replace this missing protein? And I'm very excited to tell you, we found one. So
wow.
Tony Grillo in my lab started this whole project and actually discovered a small molecule called henokitiol. It's actually isolated from the hinoki tree in Taiwan. And he discovered in a yeast assay that this small molecule can transport iron across lipid bilayers and rescue the growth of yeast, our eukaryotic cousin, okay, missing the same kind of iron transporter. And then he was able to team up and take it all the way through, even into cells, human epithelia, and eventually even into animals. And so teaming up with a group at Harvard Medical School in zebrafish, which are these really cool fish because you can see right through them. So he was able to show normal fish obviously make blood. The fish missing a protein that transports iron do not. And then he simply adds this molecule to the fish tank, and the fish regain the capacity to make blood. They call it hemoglobinization.
They ingest it? Or?
It actually diffuses through their skin, because that's one of the cool things about small molecules. They are really good at doing that. And then you restored, you know, hemoglobinization, we call it, so making of blood in the fish. And so it was really exciting. And now it also works in mice and rats. And so we're in the process of actually trying to translate that to human patients. So
what's the timeline for like a practical medicine?
Right. So it's a challenging, complicated process to actually translate something like that to people. And it can take a long time.
Yep.
And it also is very important that it's done with maximized safety consideration, of course, right? So the most important thing is do no harm, right? You don't want to hurt anyone. So at this stage, it's really helpful to get involved with experts who are really good at doing that type of translational research and finding mechanisms to, you know, engage those types of individuals. And we're working very hard on doing that right now, because we feel quite optimistic that, you know, either this molecule or something like it would be potentially very helpful in patients who are, you know, missing this protein. And more broadly, it's actually a very interesting kind of global health challenge. So iron and lack of iron is like a major driver of, you know, human health and or disease. In fact, the World Health Organization has estimated there are about 2 billion people in the world who are iron deficient. It's really a staggering number, actually. So like almost a quarter of the world's population. And it has huge consequences. So, for example, kids who don't get enough iron when they're really little can end up with IQ deficits that are permanent for the rest of their life. And so in terms of a really exciting potential problem if you could help get better iron into young kids who are either, you know, like in their environment, they don't get as much access to healthy nutrition. And then this could be like, you know, 70, 80 years of positive impact on their life. It's a very exciting, I think, way to almost add function. So, you know, we started with this idea of trying to replace missing function. But then if you kind of let your imagination keep spinning it, you get to almost, could we take a person and make them almost extra functional, like give them the ability to bring iron in from their environment that's even more than normal for any human. And you almost get like a supra physiologic, an extra enhanced physiology to, you know, better survive in an environment that's challenging, like low iron. So that's ultimately where we'd love to see something like this go.
So not only treating diseases, but helping environmental issues.
Just helping people be better, make people healthier, more healthy to start with. The goal would be, of course, don't get sick in the first place. So it's actually a very interesting idea of, you know, can you enhance human physiology in a way to better engage with your environment so that you don't get sick in the first place? And this is actually a concept that King Lee and Rashid Bashir and others at the College of Medicine were all getting very, very excited about. So we could get back to that if you like.
Well, yeah, you mentioned, you know, having access to patients to test some of these things. And obviously you're excited about the new College of Medicine. How can you talk about how it will help researchers like you and your colleagues, you know, perhaps advance these things faster or contribute to research?
Yes. Okay. So the College of Medicine is an extraordinary opportunity for our entire community. And I say in community, I mean like the whole world. And I really mean this. Like, we have here at Illinois the chance to build a new College of Medicine from scratch. I mean, it's like a once in a lifetime opportunity. We literally have a blank piece of paper, right, that we got to start with. Of course, it's no longer blank anymore because, as you know, this is really on very much underway. But it's an extraordinary situation. And so because we had a blank slate, right, we wanted to obviously do something very special, do something different. Because what the blank slate gives you is a lack of inertia, right? There's no preconceived idea about how things should be done. We had total freedom to operate. And boy, that's very exciting. So, you know, the idea that emerged that we've rallied around is, you know, health is something we all care about, right? This is the common denominator that brings us together as humanity. Everybody wants to be healthy. You know, every person, every family, every community, every country, every, you know, the whole world. Like, this is the one of those things that everybody can really kind of rally around. So as a goal, then, you say, if you get a chance to make a new college of medicine, why not make an ambitious goal to have a big impact on this kind of common theme that we all care about? So our goal is to create great healthcare for most people at low cost. And you say, okay, it's an ambitious objective, obviously. It's a challenge. But we think there's some very special things that we can do to help achieve that. And the idea that we've really gotten excited about is understanding that everybody wants to be healthy. We should say, well, there's probably a lot of great ideas out there about how to achieve that. And for a very long time, the people who are able to innovate in healthcare space has been somewhat restricted. So you need to have a lab, and you need to have infrastructure, and you need to sometimes you need to have certain degrees to get people to take you seriously and all these things. Wouldn't it be amazing if everybody could participate in the health innovation process? You've got common shared passion and very strong interest in being healthy, and you've got a lot of great ideas out there, outside the box ideas. You know, education is interesting. It's kind of paradoxical. We teach our students all this stuff, and it gives them lots of very fundamental background to innovate, but it also sometimes creates blinders as to what you think won't work. So someone coming in, we call them citizen scientists, who aren't necessarily, traditionally trained, but have lots of great ideas about how to create, you know, new ways to think about health. Boy, what if we all teamed up, right, and worked on some of these problems together? And so a mission statement, if you will, for the new College of Medicine is we want to democratize health innovation. If you could level the playing field so everybody can participate, and you think about ways to synergize scientists, engineers, and citizen scientists to think big about unmet medical needs and how we might do something about them, boy, we've now done something very special. This then becomes everybody's College of Medicine, and that's really what we want it to be. And so the starting point are our new students. We call them not just physicians, we call them physician innovators. So we want to create doctors who can innovate. They're obviously exposed directly to unmet medical needs every day, and rather than feeling like they have a certain set of tools that they need to apply, we want them to be dreaming about new tools, new strategies, new understanding that they don't currently have that would allow them to define tomorrow's healthcare, right? And so I think those physician innovators kind of end up being a beachhead, starting point for this. But we want this to, again, be globally accessible. We start to think about citizen scientists in our community, in our nation, in our world, and how do you level the playing field so everybody can participate? It becomes very powerful. We can talk about some of the specific mechanisms about how we would do that.
Well, I was thinking, so who are the citizen scientists, aside from the medical students who will actually be there?
Yes.
Are you thinking of the patients themselves or other people?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
So the ultimate objective would be to get the best idea wins, barriers out of the way. Whoever wants to participate in health innovation all of a sudden has an actionable mechanism for doing that. We think that's a very exciting objective. Okay. So then a fair question, how do you actually do
how
that?
Does that work?
How do you do that? I'll tell you a couple of specific ideas. So one is what we're calling the Medical Maker Lab. Its mission is to democratize health innovation by getting the making bottleneck out of the way. So if you remember, I talked about when I first, I think, started to realize how powerful the molecule making process starts to make you feel. Once you know you can make molecules, you start to dream about new molecules that might actually address the problem. What if we had a cross scale from molecules all the way up to, large objects, the capacity for on-demand fabrication? So like a 3D printer for anything is the concept. It's actually not so crazy. So Illinois happens to be the best in the world at making things across scales. So we have such a rich history in this university of inventing and creating and innovating ways to make things. And we have many maker labs all across our campus, as you probably know, and they have just extraordinary capacity. You come in with an idea and you can, of course, in a sense, if you're not an engineer, you can have a new prototype, printed in many cases, right, from a 3D printer or lots of other fabrication devices. We want to pull all of those resources together under a common, very powerful umbrella and fill in the gaps. So what can't we currently make on demand and then make that possible so that we ultimately have kind of a comprehensive on-demand making facility? And we want to open it up to everyone. So our medical students obviously will be one of the kind of early targets. But we can imagine, for example, a yearly competition where best idea wins. Anybody can contribute, right? Kind of a half page. This is a problem I've identified, and I think this would be a really interesting way to go after it, and have a kind of broad, diverse, kind of even international panel of experts to think about those different ideas and be able to pick a couple of them and empower those people to go for it. We actually created a coin. So we call it the Medical Maker Lab coin. It's actually a physical coin. I brought one I could show you. Once you have that coin, you can cash that coin in at the Medical Maker Lab and take any idea and turn it into a prototype. And we think if we start enabling access to those with, again, best idea wins, right? Level playing field. Doesn't matter who you are, where you came from, what your background is, high school up to, you know, your grandmother or grandfather, best idea wins. It's an incredibly exciting and actionable way to start democratizing, you know, health innovation.
So your sister's fibrosis patient could come and say, here's what's wrong with me.
Sure, absolutely.
Here's the problem you've identified. Let's make a molecule.
And it's a great one to point out, right? Because I hadn't thought of that. That's an incredibly awesome situation that's a good example of a citizen scientist and then a somewhat trained, you know, scientist having a conversation. And it's that conversation that leads to an idea.
How do we get these coins?
Yes. Actually,
you have a coin.
I did bring one, although I guess you can't see it on the airwaves. And, you know, I think it does give that, a framework, right, for doing it. Okay, so here it is. So Libby Kasich and her team actually designed this. So this is the coin.
So it looks like a giant penny.
And
says Medical Maker Lab, dream it, make it.
Dream it, make it. That's the theme. And the idea is that the bottleneck becomes imagination as opposed to the making process. And we charge our students and we charge citizen scientists with a simple task. Find a problem, make an impact. That's the goal.
Okay.
And we want to empower and enable that overall process.
So as interim dean for research at the new college, is this sort of what you're in charge of, sort of fostering this innovation process?
Sure. Well, actually, I'm a part of an incredible team, as you know. So Dean King Lee and Vice Dean Rashid Bashir and so many others. We have just such an extraordinary group of people who've just gone all in. I tell you, it's an incredible environment. We like to think it's like the Paris Cafe at the height of the modern art movement, where you've got a bunch of just like outside the box, fired up, excited, you know, really brilliant, talented people who all got together to talk about something transformative. I mean, it's just incredible. And the College of Medicine has become, I think, something that our community can just be incredibly proud of and excited about, because it is going to change the world. Mark my words.
I know the vision is grand, but how will ordinary patients here in Champaign-Urbana feel that impact, and how long will that take?
Sure.
You know, I'm a patient at Carle. You know, when will I start to see exciting things happening, or how might my medical care change because of this?
Yep. So as your question insinuates, things do take time, right, in order to make it into, you know, clinical care. And so I don't think it's possible to give any kind of specifics, right, in terms of timeline. But I think it is going to just revolutionize healthcare in our community, because all of a sudden it becomes an extremely exciting place, right, for the best in the world to come and join us and become part of our community and become participants and innovators and drivers of this, you know, new vision. So I think we are very much looking forward to many new great colleagues joining us who are going to bring so much talent and passion and innovation and great healthcare training with them, who really can help, you know, build on the strengths that are here and make us, you know, really a just absolute top-notch kind of medical care community.
Yeah. Okay. Are you at all concerned that the fundraising for the U of I side is a little bit behind schedule?
Sure. So I think has been communicated, that's understood, that the initial goals that were created actually before the college was even, you know, created over its very early days, have not yet been met. But importantly, as I think has been already discussed, we have full funding actually for the next 10 years already in place. So we are actually in very strong position in terms of being able to go after all of the goals that, you know, we've just been discussing. And currently, there's now an effort to kind of recognize the challenges associated, of course, with reaching those initial very ambitious goals. And there's a reshuffling, a redesign of strategy going on at the campus level to make sure that we actually get all of those on track. And I'm very confident if you start thinking about the tremendous, you know, potential that exists, this is, I think, going to be a fantastic opportunity for people to partner with us and to make that happen.
Is this project something that has kept you here on this campus? I mean, a lot of your colleagues, some of your colleagues have opted to leave and go elsewhere just because of budget issues and pension issues and everything else. So why are you still here?
Sure. Well, I'd say, as you could probably tell, I'm all in on this, and I think it's an incredibly exciting opportunity for our whole community. And so clearly, like, the things my lab is aiming to do are going to be powerfully accelerated and enabled and heightened because of this new College of Medicine. I think there are so many of us, I can tell you, of colleagues who are at a similar spot where they're hungry for taking things that can be developed in the lab at the basic level, and ultimately we all want that to translate, you know, to societal impact. And this is a mechanism. The new College of Medicine is a very powerful mechanism for many of us, actually, at Illinois, to be able to see things that emerge out of the lab, you know, translate into helping patients and society and health broadly defined. So I think, yes, I'm certainly going to benefit from that tremendously, and so are many of my other colleagues, and we're confident that's going to, you know, even further increase what a great place this is to do research.
Yeah. Well, good luck with the medical school project, and thanks for spending time with us
today. Okay, thanks so much.
Okay.
Thanks.